There is, I think, an important difference between the role of religion in Christendom and in the Islamic world. Now, in English, and I suppose in all the other languages of Christendom, there are two words, Christianity and Christendom. Christianism, Chrétienté, and so on. I presume you have the same distinction in German. One denotes a religion in the narrow Western sense, that is to say, a system of belief and worship. The other denotes a civilization. Now, when we in the West speak of Islam, we use the same word Islam for both, as the equivalent of Christianity, as the equivalent of Christendom. The late Marshall Hodgson of the University drew attention to this and invented a word. He suggested that in order to clarify this distinction, we should use the word Islamdom as the equivalent of Christendom. A good idea, but unfortunately it didn't take. Probably because it's a difficult word to pronounce. Not very beautiful. In Turkish, the distinction exists. In Turkish, they use Islam for the civilization and Islamiyet for the religion. But as far as I'm aware, the distinction doesn't exist in other Muslim languages. And the relationship is certainly much closer in Islam. I mentioned a moment ago the fact that Moses, while Moses was not permitted to enter his promised land and Jesus was crucified, Muhammad conquered his promised land, and it was his enemies, not he, who came to an untimely end. There is therefore a degree of interpenetration of religion and civilization in Islam, which never existed even in the Christian Middle Ages, and certainly far less so at the present time. Let me illustrate that by a simple example. When we talk of Islamic art, we mean all the art produced in the Islamic world. If we talk about Christian art, we are referring only to religious art, to votive art, to church art. If we talk about Islamic science, Islamic mathematics, Islamic physics, Islamic astronomy, we are talking about everything that was done in those fields in the great era of Islamic civilization. We don't talk about Christian astronomy or Christian biology or Christian physics. We do talk about Christian science, but that means something totally different. Here you have then two religions side by side, theologically akin, territorially contiguous, leaning, I suppose, to an inevitable clash. Most of the 14 centuries of Islamic history records the various phases of this, let me carefully choose a neutral word, of this encounter between the two, each inspired by the belief that they are carrying out God's purpose in bringing their faith to others. Now, how does one do this? At the present time, there is a good deal of indignation expressed in writings in the Middle East about the monstrous wickedness of the Crusades. The Crusaders are described as, shall we say, medieval predecessors, anticipators of the imperialist expansion of Europe some centuries later. This is, of course, nonsense. It is a perversion of history, and I am astonished to find it being accepted by so many Christians, including Christian institutions, which seem to feel it necessary to apologize. The Crusade was simply a late and rather pallid reaction to the Jihad, which came centuries earlier. The Jihad, literally striving, but given the technical meaning of striving in the cause of God by force of arms. The Jihad is a basic obligation of the Muslim faith, and began during the Prophet's lifetime and was continued under his successors. It was not by peaceful persuasion that Islam spread from Arabia to the Pyrenees and the Himalayas, from the Atlantic to the borders and beyond the borders of China. This was a series of military campaigns which in an astonishingly short time brought a very large part of the old world under Muslim rule and started one of the richest and most creative civilizations in human history. Three times Europe seemed to be in danger of Islamic conquest. The first Arab invasions of the 7th century, 7th and 8th centuries, which brought the Arab Muslims and their Berber helpers from North Africa to Spain, to Portugal, to Italy, and even at one time across the Pyrenees into France. It was held and after a long struggle reversed. The second was the coming of the Golden Horde in Eastern Europe. The Tatars, who were converted to Islam and brought again an Islamic domination to much of Eastern Europe. The Spaniards, the Portuguese, the Italians managed to reconquer their countries. The Russians managed to end what in Russian history is known as the Tatar yoke. But in the meantime, the third of the great European Muslim invasions of Europe, the Ottoman Turks, had come across the Middle East, into Anatolia, across into the Balkan Peninsula, and I need hardly remind you here, twice as far as Vienna. As late as the 17th century, there were still Turkish pashas in Buda and Belgrade, and Barbary corsairs were raiding the coasts of England and Ireland. Then came the response, the early response of the Reconquista in Spain, the Crusades. I suppose we can date the beginning of the Crusades from a moment in the 9th century when an Arab raiding party from Sicily sailed into the Tiber and sacked Rome. That is the point at which the idea of a holy war for Christendom seems to have been born and grew into the Crusades. How did they spread? Well, by mission, of course, by conversion, by persuading people to convert. And this raises also the related question of tolerance. Tolerance is, of course, an essentially intolerant idea. Tolerance means that I will allow you some of the rights which I have, not all of them, but some of them, on condition that you behave yourself according to rules which I will lay down. I think that's a fair definition of religious tolerance, wouldn't you agree? Here I cannot forbear to quote from a letter written by George Washington to the chairman of the Jewish community in Newport, Rhode Island, who had written to congratulate him on his success and spoke of tolerance. And George Washington replied, "Let us no longer speak of tolerance as if it were by the indulgence of one group that others enjoy the exercise of their inherent natural rights." It took a long time for that view to get across in the United States, and there are some areas where it hasn't yet penetrated. It's making rather less progress in most other places. Tolerance is still worth having, and it is certainly better than intolerance. Here again, there are important differences in attitude. Because Judaism and Christianity were seen as predecessors, tolerance, therefore, in Islamic law is not only permitted, it is required. It is a rule of the Sharia that those who follow a revealed faith and are monotheists are to be accorded a certain measure of tolerance. And here we come across a difficult paradox, difficult in its effect on modern Europe. The Muslim state generally did give this degree of tolerance to the Jews and to the various Christian communities, separately, of course. They were allowed the free practice of their religion, but they were allowed a lot more than that. They were allowed to form their own institutions, collect their own taxes, enforce their own laws, so that Although they suffered certain disabilities in the larger political community, they enjoyed a very large degree of independence within their own communities, so that the new Muslim communities which are now coming into existence in Christian or post-Christian Europe, on the one hand, are getting much more tolerance than they expected or ever gave to others, but on the other hand, they are getting much less tolerance than they gave in their own states and that they expect now. The Christian communities under Muslim rule ran their own schools and their own education, conducted their own courts, and as I said, even enforced their own laws, except in matters where principles of state were involved. For example, in the old days, the observance of the Muslim fast of Ramadan was enforced by state authority. If you were a Muslim, you had to fast from dawn till dusk for a whole month, and if you did not do so, you would be punished by the law and the enforcement agencies of the law. If you were a Muslim, you were not allowed to drink wine, still less to buy or sell it, which is a worse offense. If you were not a Muslim, this didn't apply. So when I was going through Ottoman documents in the 16th and 17th centuries, local orders, there's a lot of discussion of such problems as how do you prevent Muslim guests at Christian weddings from drinking wine. Christians are allowed to use wine at their weddings, and they're allowed to have Muslim friends and invite them. But how do you prevent the breaking of this commandment by Jewish and Christian hosts inviting Muslim guests? And a lot of other things of the same sort. There is a delightful story which I can't forbear to tell you. The tale is told of a dervish. The dervishes are notoriously lax in their religious observances. They achieved unity with God by ecstasy, and therefore didn't worry too much about prayer and fasting and other such nuisances. Now, a dervish was caught eating during Ramadan and was promptly thrown into jail. Sitting in his jail cell, he looked out of the window, and there was a man in the street outside eating a kebab in broad daylight. And the dervish called out to him and said, "Hey, you're eating." The man said, "Yes, I'm eating." And the dervish said, "It's Ramadan." And the man said, "Yes, I know, it's Ramadan." And the dervish said, "If anyone sees you, you'll be arrested and thrown into jail where I am." The man said, "No, it doesn't apply to us." The dervish said, "What do you mean it doesn't apply to you?" And the man said, "I'm a Christian, and this is only for Muslims." And the dervish said, "You mean because you're a Christian, you're allowed to eat a kebab in the street in broad daylight?" And the man said, "Yes, I am. This is a Muslim rule. It doesn't apply to us." And the dervish thought for a moment, and he said, "You should give thanks to Allah every day that you are not of the true faith." This is a very old story. I don't guarantee its authenticity, but it expresses an attitude. You find that such matters as marriage. Muslim law allows polygamy and concubinage. Christian law allows neither. The Christian authorities were able to punish Christians who violated these laws. Any Christian who practiced polygamy or bought a slave, he was allowed to own a slave, but he was not allowed to use her as a concubine. He could be severely punished by Christian authority for violating what was perfectly normal and acceptable under the laws of the state. I quote these examples to show that tolerance can have different meanings in different ways. Regarding study, the spreading of the religion, Christians institutionalized the mission, Muslims didn't. It spread by a kind of osmosis, private enterprise, individual contacts, and more particularly the dervish orders. The Muslims don't seem to have developed at any time anything corresponding to the organized Christian missions. And that, I suppose, may be explained at least in part by the lack of ecclesiastical institutions in pre-modern Islamic history. Let me come to my last topic, and that is how they looked at each other. In the Christian world, we find from a very early date an attempt to understand this neighboring religion, even while rejecting and condemning it. The first students of Islam in Christian Europe are almost without exception churchmen, monks, priests, and others who took the trouble to learn Arabic and to read the Quran, and even at quite an early date to make a Latin translation of the Quran, so that they should know who they were dealing with, so that they should understand enough of Islam to be able to defend Christianity against, to protect Christians from conversion to Islam, or even to try and convert Muslims to Christianity. It took some time. Eventually they decided that the first was unnecessary and the second was impossible. But in the meantime, the study developed. By the Renaissance, we already find numerous centers for Arabic studies in Italy and elsewhere, helped by members of the Christian minorities, Arabic-speaking Christians from the Levant, particularly from the Maronite community, which was in communion with Rome, who went to Rome and then beyond to Spain, to France, bringing with them a knowledge of the Arabic language and teaching it. By the 16th century, they're already chairs of Arabic in a number of European universities, and Arabic is taught. It's interesting that this was not for practical purposes. If they had been doing it for practical purposes, they would have been studying Turkish, not Arabic, because by the 16th and 17th centuries, Turkish was the language of power, the language of government, the language of commerce in the Islamic world. No, these were universities. They didn't have chairs of English or French or German. These were not fit subjects for a university. Classical Arabic fitted alongside Latin and Greek and Biblical Hebrew, and it had a proper place in the university. By the 18th century, by the early 18th century, there are already available in most of the languages of Christian Europe hundreds and hundreds of books about Islam, about Arabic literature, about Middle Eastern history, and so on. Arabic grammars, dictionaries, editions of texts, translations, and so on. These are all the work of a new breed that appeared about the time of the Renaissance, who came to be known as Orientalists. The word was coined on the analogy of Latinist, Hellenist, Hebraist, Orientalist. At that time, Orient meant the Near East. They were almost totally unaware of anything beyond that. It wasn't until much later that the Orient, the East, was extended to include such remote places as India and China. And that, of course, was when they found it necessary to rename the East, the Middle East or the Near East. First the Near East and then the Middle East. What is remarkable is that we find no equivalent movement on the other side. A total disregard of Europe, of its languages, of its culture, a total lack of interest in anything emanating from the European or Christian world. Partly, obviously, this is religiously biased. If you assume that Christianity is last year's model, an outdated, superseded version of the true faith, of which Islam is the final and perfect version, then it doesn't make any kind of sense to study the old version when you have the new version. The only book that I know of that was translated into Turkish was a treatise on the treatment of syphilis. Syphilis was brought from the American colonies. It spread with astonishing rapidity. It already reached the end, by the end of the 15th century, cases are already reported in eastern Turkey and Iran. It was known, it is still known at the present day, as the Frankish disease, since it came from the lands of the Franks. And therefore, it was legitimate to use a Frankish book to deal with a Frankish disease. So there is an early Turkish translation of a treatise on the diagnosis and treatment of syphilis. And for centuries, that was the only one. There is a history of the kings of France, exists only in manuscript, and in a single manuscript, which is in Leipzig. Obviously, there was no great interest in this in Turkey. It isn't until a comparatively late stage that there is a stirring of interest in Europe, its languages, and its cultures. If, as has sometimes been argued, Orientalism is a manifestation of imperialist domination, then one must, I think, totally acquit the Arabs and the Turks of any such crime. During the centuries that they ruled Spain, they never made the slightest attempt to learn Spanish or Latin. During the centuries that the Ottomans ruled Balkan and Central Europe, they never disclosed the slightest interest in any of the languages, ancient or modern, of those places. When they needed translators, which was frequently, they used either converts or local Christians. The great change begins with the weakness of the Islamic world and the awareness of that weakness in contrast with Europe. Let me conclude with a quotation from the 18th century English lexicographer Dr. Samuel Johnson, one that I particularly like. He says, "A generous and elevated mind is distinguished by nothing more certainly than an eminent degree of curiosity. Nor is that curiosity ever more agreeably or usefully employed than in examining the laws and customs of foreign nations." Thank you.